Okay, welcome back out there in Video Land. As you can see out there, we have a different table arrangement, and we have 17 wonderful folks sitting in here. Turn around, wave at the camera. Everybody, come on, turn around, wave. All right, welcome. Okay, so today we're going to start talking a little bit about an overview of learning and what it is, and then we'll move into the next module, which basically is some historical stuff. So when you talk about learning, you have to ask, what is it, all right? And there's lots of different definitions of learning that we have, all right? And the classic one is from Webster's, start with the dictionary, right? Does anybody even know what a dictionary is anymore? Do you even use it?
It's online.
It's online, online dictionaries, yeah. I mean, you have Bing and you have everybody else now, right? To tell you what it is. But anyway, it's an act or experience that of one that learns, that's one definition, or knowledge or skill acquired by instruction or study. Those are the classic ones that you talk about in the general lay field, all right? In older psychology models, the classic example is the behaviorists. It was basically defined, learning was defined as basically changes in behavior as a result of experience. And so as you can see here, there is a variety of different types. And when we talk about older psychology, and we talk about the different models of psychology over the course of the semester, you're going to find that the way this changes, or this definition that we have here, has been modified depending upon the zeitgeist of psychology at the time, and we'll come back and talk about that a little bit later, but we have to have some kind of definition, okay? And so the definition that we're going to use for learning is the one that Klein provides. And that, in fact, I think it is a pretty good one for all of us that we can use in a variety of different contexts. And that is, it's an experiential, not experimental. It's an experiential process resulting in a relatively permanent change in behavior that can be explained by temporary states, maturation, or innate response tendencies. Okay? So for you that are frantically writing real fast, all of this stuff is in the PowerPoints, and you can go back and download this and actually see this a little bit better. But it's an experiential process. So what does all that mean? So let's talk about that. There's three major points that Klein makes. The change in the potential for the behavior. Behavior is relatively permanent, and other processes can also be important as part of the learning process. So let's talk about these, all right? Change in the potential for a behavior. Learning reflects a change in the potential for a behavior. It doesn't automatically lead to a change in the behavior. Does that make sense? So it's basically, it's a change in the potential to do something different, but it doesn't automatically lead to doing it. All right. In the old days, that's what we call learning. And today, we don't. All right. So you may do it or you may not. All right. Number two, second point Klein makes: behavior is relatively permanent. That is, changes that we have out there are relatively permanent. And new experiences can, in essence, override previously learned behavior. You can just slide that there over there in the back over there. Okay? New experiences can override previously learned behavior. And that's really, really important because we all have new things, right? We're always making new changes in our life. And as a result of that, we modify, we adapt, we look at changes, we do different things, etc. All right? So an example might be, in the old days when we had 2 feet of snow, what might I do? I would go out with my handy dandy little snow shovel, and I would pick up a shovel of snow, and I'd flop it over, right? And I'd do it again until my driveway was clean, which would take an hour, maybe longer, depending on how much snow was there. So what did I learn? What did I figure out there? That takes a long time, right? And so I need to modify my behavior in order to take care of my snow. And so what did I do? I went and bought a big snowblower, right? So now I go out there and I make five swaths, and it's done. And of course, now I'm a guy. And guys like toys, right? Right, ladies? Guys like toys. You always like tools, right? And so we have this toy. And so I not only have to do my driveway, I have to do my neighbor's driveway next door because they don't have one. And they never shovel their driveway. So I do theirs. And I do the sidewalk. And I go down to the old guy two houses down from me. And I do his driveway because that's what you do with people who are elderly, right? And if you're not doing that, shame on you. You need to help out your elderly folk out there. You're all going to be there someday. So there's an old saying, what goes around comes around. So think about that. Okay? So new experiences can override old behavior. Other processes can also cause changes in behavior. All right? Classic example, the reason that you eat is primarily motivated by the physiological processes that you have in your body. All right? That is your blood sugar. Your blood sugar drops, what do? You go get some food. All right? And depending upon the kind of food that's available, it may be healthy food, or it may be a Snickers bar, or whatever it may be. Or if you're in the comments, it's a bagel, right? Or whatever. Okay? Or you can try to eat healthy, right? So you have the granola bar, right? The little I'm not going to tell you what kind, there's a lot of different ones, but you have the little granola bar. Anybody ever look at how many calories are on those little granola bars? Ranges between 160 and 250. All those little things. It's the same as a Snickers bar. Okay? Which tastes better? A Snickers bar, right? Okay. So, eating can be motivated by other things, all right? However, eating can also be influenced by a type of learning that we call classical conditioning, all right? And or experiences with new food, all right? So here's the classic example. Let's say that you go to the new restaurant down the street, whatever it is, and somebody comes up to you and says, oh, you should try this. And so you try that, and you eat it, and you go home, and you puke your guts out. What did you learn from that?
You don't like it.
You don't eat that anymore, right? All right, we're going on a tangent here for a minute. My phone is ringing, okay? I called this guy at 9:20, said, I will call you at 11, or call me after class at 11. What does he do? Call me right now. Doesn't listen. All right. Be quiet now. All right. All right. So that's a type of learning that we have. All right. We call that poison-based avoidance condition. And so you don't eat that anymore. Or you also have learned, all of you have learned a basic strategy. You get up. What do? You take your shower and you have breakfast. And then at noon, what do? You eat lunch. And then about 5 or 6 o'clock, you eat dinner. And then at 10 o'clock, you
have second dinner.
Have second dinner or a snack. Right, yes, very good. All right. So, so every day you do that. What happens when you go and you sleep in and you eat breakfast at 10? What happens at noon? Oftentimes you're hungry again. And that has to do with a type of learning called temporal learning. Basically, the time of day basically becomes a cue for you to eat. Or another type of learning basically relies on cues that you get out in your environment. The classic example is the best classically conditioned thing in the world against all of us, and that is McDonald's Golden Arches. So you had a good breakfast, and you're driving on the road, and at 10 o'clock, you come up, and there it is, out there in the distance, 2 miles out, and you see these great big things out there, the big M. And by the time you get there, what are you? You're already starting to get hungry. It's a classically conditioned cue, all right? And those are the kinds of things that happen. So changes can be motivated other by learning, such as here, but other things in your environment also have huge impacts in the way you behave, all right? And those impacts are really, really, really important, all right? All right, so when you talk about learning, when you talk about the different definitions, you need to kind of keep that stuff in the back of your mind, all right? Really, really important. Okay, now, there's a lot of assumptions and a lot of trends that have influenced learning over time. And we're going to talk about these over the course of the semester. And a lot of this stuff, and you need to kind of remember, is that psychology comes out of the disciplines of philosophy, and it comes out of the disciplines of medicine and physiology, okay? So it's not just this stuff that just developed on its own. It's taken information and influences from a variety of different disciplines. And learning has really been the field that's done that. That is the whole field of experimental psychology in general. So when you talk about them, you talk about learning and you talk about models of learning, you have to look at the philosophy that comes from behind it. And the first type of learning, or the models of learning and the philosophical impacts on the learning field of learning, are what we call from the empiricists. And there's two classic examples, two individuals that stand out from within the empiricist model. And that is Aristotle and Locke. And what Aristotle and Locke basically say is this: all knowledge that you have comes from experience. Nothing is genetically programmed in you. Nothing is innate. Everything, so when you are born, you basically have what Aristotle called a tabula rasa. That is, your mind, your brain is basically a blank slate. And if coming from the time of Aristotle and more of Locke, where you have kind of the blackboard type of model, that's what they're talking about. It's basically a blank slate of stone. It's nothing on it. And from the time you're born, you start to put information onto that black slate. And you chisel it in the old days. Today, you then put it on with a pencil, or you use a piece of a charcoal out of the fireplace, a la Lincoln, and all that story. And but in essence, that's what you would be doing. Okay. Today, we use it from a computer model. You take it and you type it in, right? So you're basically, that's what you're doing. But for the empiricists, there was nothing. And then what you did was add more and more and more and more and more to it. Okay? That's in contrast to the nativists, or nativism. And the nativism, or within nativism, basically what you're saying is that all, and the classic example of that person, for the major philosopher that comes from that, is Plato. Alright? So you have this conflict and contrast between Aristotle and Plato. We're going to talk more about that later. But basically, Plato argues, and the nativists argue, is that when you're born, you have all knowledge within you. You're born with lots and lots of information. But what you have to do is you have to use different ways to get that information out, for you to learn and basically understand it. And the way that Plato did and talks about it is you would use reasoning and you would use a questioning type of model, all right? So basically, we would question you, and from that questioning, you would be able to come up with the answer to a particular type of question. Why is there air? Why is there life? Whatever that may be, okay? The philosophical issues of the day. And that's what you would talk about, and we would question you back and forth to try to get that information out, okay? We sort of use that in the Socratic method as well, when we use the Socratic method of inquiry, which I will use with you someday, okay? You won't like it. Versus the rationalists, all right? Okay, so the rationalists basically say the way that we get information, the way that we learn, is we reason about things, all right? We develop, we get our knowledge by reasoning. So we analytically analyze it, we reason about it, and from that way, we are able to then get some particular level of information from them. So what you have, in essence, are these different competing methodologies of philosophy trying to explain why you behave the way you do within learning, all right? And in, from a different perspective, from a philosophical perspective, this was not only trying to explain learning, but it was also trying to explain and use a methodology for which you would develop understanding. And so when you look at all the old philosophical teachers, and all the way up until basically the 1600s, that's what they're primarily using. And it goes back and forth of how much philosophy becomes so important and how much it goes away. Okay? Versus the determinists. All right? The determinists are a little bit different group. All right? And what they say is that all behavior is predictable. That is, I can predict exactly what you're going to do before you even know what you're going to do. Okay? And basically, your behavior is determined by your heredity and your environment.
Go ahead. So that pretty much takes free will. Like that's
correct. Okay. Yeah. So there doesn't exist.
Right.
So basically, it's going to include your past environment. It's going to include your current environment, and on and on and on. So all your behavior is predictable. And I will tell you, there's some pretty good evidence to support that. In fact, there's a model that was developed by a guy named Louis Gray called Satisfaction Balance, and he could predict within about 75% accuracy exactly what you would do under certain circumstances. And then he started looking at groups, and with groups, he could predict even higher rates. That's what we talk about in sociology. And for the most part, for you people who are sociology folk and have had a lot of some of that stuff, I will tell you, it's pretty uncanny the way you can manipulate behavior within groups. I can manipulate all of you. And you may not like it, but you'll do it. Okay? So I'll give you an example. Take out half a sheet of paper. No, stop. You all did it, didn't you? Why? Go ahead.
So you're a teacher, you have the authority to do
that? That's right, it's a power thing. I love it. Okay, but it's true, okay? People look to authority figures for a variety of different things, all right? And so you can control people in that manner, all right? To a degree. And there are consequences if you do not sometimes. So for those people that didn't take out the half sheet of paper, and I gave you a quiz and I had you turn it in, and you didn't have the points, what have you learned from the past? You want that half sheet of paper out and you want those points, right? Because those points equate to a grade, and all those grades equate to graduate school. And graduate school equates to lots of money, which is what you're all wanting to do. So you can have your 2 and 1/4 kids and a dog and a house in the suburbs, right? Isn't that what it's all about? Although, well, we don't get Social Security anymore, so you'll never get this, but all right. Finally, we also have another one we all have out there called free will. And what the free will advocates basically say is that you have the power to determine your actions. You're responsible for your behavior, not your environment, not your genetics, not all the other good stuff that's floating around out there. It's you. You make a decision that you're going to do it. Some of this comes out of the religious environments and the religious models. Others of it come out from the basic models that we talk about in philosophy. Okay? But so what we have is a bunch of different models. All right. So in general, we've talked about a variety of different things here. All right. Each of these have their proponents, and you have heard all of these. This is should be nothing new to any of you. I've just clarified it and defined it in a little bit more more sequential manner for you to remember. All right. So that's the first major, when you talk about philosophy, that's the first major groups. All right. Now there's a second major group of thought, and that is basically associationism versus atomism. And associationism This is basically, you develop knowledge and information is from a series of connections or associations about a variety of things, whatever those associations may be. Right? All right, there's nobody out here, so I'm good. Right, so, atomism is basically the idea that complex things come from simpler things. Comes out of the models of chemistry. We're going to talk about that. And that complex things can be broken down into its simple elements. And of course, you have to assume that something's connected. So the reason that you took out those pieces of paper when I told you to do is from some kind of previous information that you have learned, all right? So the complex behaviors that you emit basically come from a combination of simpler behaviors that are out there. So you're all writing frantically right now because for a variety of reasons, all right? And I can do that. So how did you learn to write? All those kinds of things come together. Your knowledge of writing, your knowledge of language, and all those other kinds of things, spelling, those all come together, say the atomists, to make a complex behavior called writing notes for this class. Straightforward, right? So that's the second part, okay? Now the third major group that comes out of the third major influence that we talk about in learning comes out of the group called the scientific materialists. And basically what the scientific materialists kind of and sort of are you can kind of think about them as the early behaviorists. And what they basically say is this: you don't need anything beyond basic, pure, scientific and physical principles to understand learning or understand behavior. People can explain by the physical principles without some kind of special life force. And the classic example of that is, we call that the mind. Okay? This is initially coming out of the early behaviors going against the early cognitive psychologists. All right, so the classic examples of the Watsonians and Hullians talking against people such as Guthrie, and talking about people such as Pullman, okay, etc. And those are the kinds of the two major groups that are out there. And so we can use the same terms for humans as we use for other things and for the other organisms. So you don't need to go beyond the basic science, say the scientific materialists. All right. So, in general, when you look at things from a learning perspective, when you look at the overall view from the philosophy, this is where they're coming from, right? And that's what you need to remember. You need to always keep that in the back of your mind. If you do that, you're going to stay on task. Okay? Questions? Yes.
Is nativism the same as a functionalist?
No, not it uses some of that, but it's a totally different philosophical bent. We're going to talk about functionalists down the road, so don't just hold off on that for two lectures and we'll be good. Okay. Questions? All right. So that concludes this section. We'll talk about the next section shortly. You take care.